This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild. Welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about the Iraq War and maybe war in general with Tyler Boudreaux, author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Tyler Boudreaux, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you here. You wrote an article for us in the February issue of the Progressive Magazine. And I was, ever since I got that manuscript, wanting to read your book and then to get you here, if possible, and talk to you in person, because that's how I prefer to do interviews. I know some people like to do them over the phone, but I like to actually see the person and get to know the person a little bit. But let's start on the book itself, and or maybe before that, because you write in the book that you've always, or for a long time, considered yourself a writer, or maybe a writer as a hobby. Mm. How did the hobby start?
I don't know if I was doing it long before. I was taking notes in Iraq of my experiences, and I mean, I think that the title of the book even deserves a little bit of explanation. I mean, I studied literature in college. I didn't really do much writing, you know, other than what they made me do. Anyway, I had a bunch of books that I wanted to bring to Iraq, stuffed them in my sea bag, got to Kuwait, opened the bag, and on the top of the heap was Dante's Inferno, which was sort of an accident. I didn't plan to bring it, but I said to myself, well, they say war is hell, so, you know, I guess I'll go ahead and read it. So as I was driving, you know, physically up from Kuwait into Baghdad, into Iraq, I'm traveling down through the circles of hell with Dante and Virgil, and I just started to notice these, you know, sort of remarkable parallels, because each circle of hell, for those, you know, people who haven't read it recently, each circle of hell, Dante sort of explores the moral and political issues of his time and his country, and I just kept on coming up with these, you know, these similarities, but, you know, of the issues of our time and our country, and so I just started to take notes and make note of these things. And
it's a very powerful book, Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine, and you use the Dante quote, you know, abandon all hope, all ye who enter. Mm. But you don't say war is hell. You kind of have an adaptation of that phrase. And what is that adaptation?
That's right. War is the foyer to hell.
And why is war the foyer to hell?
Well, you know, in a sort of a realistic sense, when the soldier is in combat, I mean, it's got all the horrors that we talk about, all of the ugliness, except that he's in the fight, he's in the moment. Even at its worst, you know, I don't know what, you know, maybe it's adrenaline, or maybe it's, you know, just being focused, or all these other things, the fight or flight. I mean, I suppose you could explain it any number of ways, but in the moment, you know, he's not down about it. He's not, you know, he's just sort of in the moment. But then you get back home after all this, and all these memories and experiences start to settle out. And that's when things start to really seem hellish, you know, that churning emotions. That's when it really gets hard to deal with.
So coming home is more of the hell than the war itself.
Yeah, I think that's when the soldier actually gets to really acknowledge what's happened. You know, I mean, that's not to sort of reduce the value of what's actually happened at war. I just mean, you know, I guess that phrase that I use is more from the perspective of that soldier.
Another thing that you talk about very early on in the book, and it's a theme that runs through it, and that is this lust for war, or
yeah,
more specifically, lust for killing.
Right,
explain
right.
What that is?
Well, I mean, I think that there is a, you know, sort of a natural aggressive tendency in males. I mean, I see it in my young boys. And yet there's something perverted about what's happened, you know, to a soldier. And it's done so deliberately. I mean, and so, you know, one of the things I point out in the article is there's been this evolution of training over the last, you know, 50, 60 years, where after World War II, they kind of recognized, well, not enough guys are shooting their guns because they don't want to kill. So, you know, we can actually increase our firepower just by conditioning them not to mind killing so much. And so over the decades, they did this sort of desensitization and developed this, you know, kind of a bloodlust, you know, and that's really kind of what it amounts to. And we were talking just a moment ago about Dan Ellsberg, how he had reacted to my book and said, you know, I really don't feel like this description of training is accurate. You know, it's not what I experienced back in the 50s, which is when he was a Marine. And, you know, we talked it over and we recognized that times have changed. But, I mean, he was quite bothered by this passage, you know, and you know, to the point that he said he recommended I take it out.
The passage is quite vivid, too. The passage is, you know, how long can you train to, you know, gouge someone's eye out before you really just want to step on that eyeball? How long can you train for crushing someone's skull with your heel before you really want to crush that person's skull?
And that is exactly the culture in the military now, where you really have this like energetic enthusiasm towards killing, and there's a purpose for it. The purpose is to get, you know, good at killing if that's your job. I mean, it makes sense. It's just, where does this bring us? But something occurred to me. You know, I said to myself, well, why is it that Dan Ellsberg, 79 years old, PhD, former Marine, been to Vietnam, in the Pentagon. I mean, been all over. Done it, you know, he's done everything. Why is it he picks up this book, reads this passage, and is appalled? But me, at 18 years old, walks in the door of boot camp, and I'm not appalled. Why is that?
And what's your answer to that?
And the conclusion is really, you know, the only conclusion you can come up with is that it's not just the military that has slowly become desensitized. It's also the society, because if it wasn't, they wouldn't get any recruits. The recruits would come in and they'd be appalled. And they'd say, this doesn't, you know. But it resonated deeply with me immediately, and I'm saying,
is it because we're saturated in war movies?
Well, I think that's you know, why we're desensitized is a kind of a long discussion. I sort of see it as all this trajectory from, you know, the World War II, Industrial Revolution, whatever, you know, and then sending us forward in this mindset of efficiency, and, you know, and then plus you have that post-World War II like building up of a huge professional army. I mean, all those things could have linked together, and, you know, the movies and the video games and all those things, I feel like those are really symptoms rather than, you know, the core problem. But it's clear that today's society is just not as sensitized to violence and killing.
Why did you enlist in the first place?
The reasons that I joined the Marine Corps are sort of a collection of the usual, you know, esprit de corps and camaraderie and the nobility of serving one's country and all that sort of thing. But at the heart of it all was looking for some individual challenge.
You were young at the time, right?
Yeah, out of high school. Enlisted right out of high school. And this was 1989, so there was no war, so it's different than the decision that young people make today when they go in, because they know where they're headed. But I regarded war more as, it was just an idea. It was, you know, it was sort of a myth or a fantasy or whatever. And it wasn't one that I was unhappy about. It wasn't one that I was looking to avoid. It was, I regarded it as sort of like the final test. All right. So, in other words, you know, I wanted some, you know, nice, tough, grueling training so that I could go home and tell guys, you know, wow, look what I did. But then I knew that ultimately the experience would not be complete until I had been tested in combat.
It was a test of manhood in a way.
I think so. I think that's the way I felt about it at the time.
And you, what was your experience? Where were you on 9/11, and did you instantly know that things were going to change?
Huh. Well, yeah, I, of course, I know exactly where I was on 9/11. I was training recruits in San Diego, training recruits to be new Marines. And I was right in on the angry momentum, you know, the wave of sort of outrage that sort of swept across much of the country. I was right there in it and anxious to get in whatever fight was to be had. And this is tied into, you know, a story that we haven't gotten into, but, you know, this long history of wanting to be tested. So I'm at 18. I say, I know ultimately I need to be tested. Well, the years go by and I sort of keep missing out. I was in during the Gulf War, but I was stationed in New Jersey, so I didn't go. And then I went to ROTC in college, and that was 93 to 97. So I miss out on Somalia. I miss out on Yugoslavia. Then I get back in and there's no war. And then I hit San Diego. And, you know, all these years I've been training and I'm saying, okay, I'm ready for this test. And so that warrior culture demands that sooner or later, you know, you get your hands dirty.
And you got your hands dirty finally, not in Afghanistan. but in Iraq.
Yes.
And you talk about, interestingly, that at the beginning, your commanding officers was talking about the need to wave to the Iraqis. This is a hearts and minds strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm speaking with Tyler Boudreau, by the way. He's the author of a really gripping book that I highly recommend called Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. And I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. How long did that waving to Iraqi strategy last?
Well, let me just back up for a minute because I want to explain how I get involved in this. And from the beginning, when the invasion of Iraq occurred, it didn't resonate with me. I wasn't interested in it. I was kind of like, this doesn't strike me as Marine. I sort of view my service as sort of like this defense, and this doesn't sit right. Now, I wasn't very politically aware, but just from a sort of a Marine point of view, I wasn't that happy about it.
And was that common among other Marines?
I think that there was, we chatted about it. Typically, the guys in uniform shy away from political discussions because they know inherently that they are instruments of policy and that they don't have a choice. And it's best not to get too, stuck on one or the other until it's, until it's executed. So that's difficult. Mm-hmm. So we tend to walk away from it a little bit. But I, so I had this sort of reluctance about it, but it wasn't strong enough to get me out. But anyway, so you remember that in the beginning, it was all about weapons of mass destruction, and I was sort of leery about this idea. And then, the WMD was never found, and it sort of fell off the table. And all of a sudden, it became liberation. It became democracy. It became freedom and these sorts of things. That kind of language was used. And this ended up being very convenient for me because I was looking for a surface rationale. I mean, I couldn't exactly say to people, I really want to go to Iraq so I can get in the fight. I couldn't even say that to myself, really, even though there was some of that sentiment there. What I needed was something to justify it and a more noble reason. Now, all of a sudden, I've got it. So this is, so I go to back to the operating forces. I'm an infantry officer. And General Mattis, James Mattis, he's sort of got this, very gungy kind of warrior, even almost in the media sometimes a warmonger reputation. And but this guy who, everyone's like, oh, he's a warmonger. This is the guy who comes to us and says the reason why we have an insurgency is because the army is mishandling the Iraqi people. It's because they're not respecting the Iraqi people. They're not, they're disregarding their humanity. I mean, all these kinds of things. This is what he's saying to all the Marines, not just to a few officers. I mean, to the whole, the whole unit. And he says, we are going to get it right. The Marine Corps is going to go over there. We're going to wear a different uniform. We're going to get this right. And this was good because for me, I was like, okay, good. I'm glad to hear that kind of language coming from the top. It sort of reinforces my rationale to sort of involve myself in this operation. And you see how much is riding on this rationale. Okay, everything is sitting on that. And my whole justification for being there is sitting on there. So I'm paying close attention to this whole thing. So now you mentioned the wave tactics. He said one of the ways that we're going to, extend ourselves to the Iraqi people, one of the ways that we're going to, show them we want to be friends is we're going to wave at them. He said every time you see an Iraqi person walking by, I want you to wave and smile. So, this will prove to them that, we're good folks. And so that's what we did. We're Marines. He's a general. And we're driving north. And, there I am hanging outside of the window. And with one hand, I'm waving and smiling. With the other hand, I'm pointing my rifle at them. And, I think that even in the moment, most of the Marines kind of gathered that this might have looked a little dumb to the Iraqi people. Like, what is the story here? But what we didn't capture in the moment, I don't think, I didn't, and I don't think most did, is how it looked to ourselves. In other words, there's a division there, and who are we? Are we waving? Because when I wave and smile at someone, unless I'm faking, I mean some good thoughts. I mean friendly thoughts. And when I point a loaded weapon at someone with my finger on the trigger, I'm attaching these feelings of hostility.
I mean, that's an irreconcilable division, though, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And so in other words, exactly right. It is irreconcilable, and it must be resolved. You cannot continue to just move in this with this dichotomy going on. It must be resolved. And so you asked, how long did it last? Well, we had a Marine hit by a roadside bomb, and from that day on, nobody waved, and that was 3 days. Mm. 3 days in country, and the wave tactics disappeared in my unit, and I'm sure that the similar experience happened elsewhere, and the conflict is resolved. That's the important thing. Not just the wave tactics went away. That was symbolic of the fact that the conflict is resolved, and now we know what we're doing there. We're there to fight.
But it was resolved, Tyler Boudreau, in a way that couldn't have sit real well with you, because you said everything was riding on the possibility of having a higher motive.
Exactly right. So now, not to say that that the projects that we had gone there to do stopped. Of course, we continued to do, you know, the building of water treatment facilities and the clinics and the schools and going to town councils meetings and spending cash. And so those operations continued. It's just how much is every Marine's heart and mind into this, and every casualty we take, you know, every time we get shot at, every guy that gets killed, that, you know, that genuine effort, you know, enthusiasm towards, you know, connecting with Iraqi people diminishes, and it becomes just a fight. And that's what happened in my experience in 2004, is that we got in more and more fights over that period of that deployment. And I'm looking at a mission statement that says stabilize the region. And things were getting less and less stable as we went along. And, you know, it was kind of interesting listening to the colonel congratulate us for having fought well. Good job, Marines. You fought well. You fought bravely. And in that very statement, he's acknowledged that these things aren't stable, because if they were, we wouldn't be fighting. And he tips his hand to that point a number of times. And yet when I look around left and right and up and down, nobody seems to really be acknowledging that we're not quite accomplishing the task that I'm looking at on a mission statement. I'm not talking about in some broad political sense. I'm talking about specific mission statements that are not being achieved. I mean, it was like, you know, you imagine World War II on D-Day. We try to land on Normandy. We can't. We go back to the ships and call home and say, yep, we did it. We landed. I mean, how long could we get away with that before someone was like, but you're not there. You didn't accomplish the mission, and we've got to get this thing done. So get your butts back to shore. Well, it was that's what it was like. It's like we called home and said, yep, freedom has taken hold. That was the phrase. You know, your freedom has taken hold because of what these Marines have done. And I'm thinking to myself, but wait a second. This isn't stable. This isn't true. And nobody is concerned about making corrective action. And that's where I start to get more concerned. So all of my talk about the war, all of the, you know, sort of moral discussions that I get into, all stemmed from a tactical observation, you know, sort of saying, as an infantry officer, I'm not feeling like we're getting the job done here.
Well, another moral concern had to be, and you write about it in this book, Packing Inferno, Tyler Boudreau, was Abu Ghraib. And what effect that had on you?
Abu Ghraib was present in our experience because of its proximity to us and because of in time and space. So, you know, it was 04 and I was right, you know, we're right down the street and the news comes out and they've got these people, you know, all these pictures that you've all seen. And I don't have any personal experience with Abu Ghraib, but we talked about it for sure. And I think that some people were pretty I'd say that majority of people were upset to see this had happened. And it struck, at least in the circles that I went in, and mostly officers that I talked to, it struck us as, you know, un-American, unmilitary. We were like, what is this? This isn't us. This isn't what we do. And now, why did it happen? I mean, you know, and of course, this is not something that we have any personal knowledge of. The immediate response from the officers, I think, universally is, where the heck was the chain of command? Where are the people who are in charge making sure this doesn't happen? Because that's our view of our military service. You know, it's making sure, you know, if something, you know, doesn't go right, you're the guy in charge. It's your charge. You know, it's your responsibility. So that's how we think about it. And I take that state of mind and I'm thinking, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And at what point, where do we cut that chain of command off and say, this is the person responsible? And, you know, well, of course, you read all the articles. I mean, it seems to
How
happen.
High up does that go in
That's
your
right.
view? I mean, do you think it goes up to Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush? Or
I mean, I've just read, you know, articles, so I don't have any knowledge. I mean, it appears from what I've read that, you know, there may have been, like, direct, you know, information coming from all the way to the top. But even so, like, what's going on even within the unit level?
And you said there was a very small incident that is not nearly the magnitude of Abu Ghraib that you were able to observe these guys being held in really tiny cages and some of them being shocked.
I didn't observe the shocking, but it came out later. Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of more of a personal experience. We had our own little sort of it was a temporary detention facility. It wasn't like someplace that anybody would spend a long period of time in. But nevertheless, it was more or less, it was like a kennel. It was like a kennel in a tent. You'd walk into the tent, and there were cages. And it was big enough for them to stand up. I suppose they could lie down, although everybody was sitting, so I didn't actually get a chance to, you know, figure out the dimensions on the floor. But they were relatively small cages, and anybody who was detained by us would be held in these cages for a while. I imagine probably not more than a few days, and then we would do sort of a very low level. Not interrogation, just interviews, I think. You know, we had some human exploitation team guys there, but their authority is limited. So, you know, they would question for a while. If they felt like there was something more, then they would be passed on to some higher level. And if they felt like there was nothing there, then we would let them go. But nevertheless, here they are sitting in these cages for even a couple of days. And this is one of the things that I point out of many things. You know, even if it's a day, even if it's an hour, who wants to be in a cage at all? Who wants to have a bag put over their head and their hands, you know, ziplocked and put in a cage only to find out like, you know, 2 hours later, oh, sorry, we got the wrong guy. Oh, well, I'm not happy with you at this point. And so all this ties back to my kind of observation of, okay, if the key to undermining the insurgency is to winning popular support, then things like this are working against us, you know, and I think that what we did as Marines is we would always look at things in the sort of immediate tactical mindset without really acknowledging how it might impact things on the, you know, kind of the longer scale.
And it sounded like there was ambiguous orders from above. You mentioned one commanding officer telling the other Marines that, you know, someone who was had a hood over his head and had his arms behind his back, handcuffed, was dropped off or fell off yeah. a tank or something, and we can't let that happen again, can we? And everybody kind of laughs.
Ambiguous emotion, not ambiguous orders, because it was never a question that shouldn't happen. It was a guy who fell off the back of, you know, it was I wasn't there, but basically mishandled, and this guy falls off. So maybe he's like outright shoved off the back of a truck, which wouldn't astonish me in the slightest bit, because I'm talking about this escalation of animosity. And as we start taking casualties, our sympathy for the Iraqi people in general goes down, but particularly those who we have detained, because, you know, it's just like, you know, when a guy is arrested, I mean, he's not found guilty, but there's a certain attitude towards this person as soon as the handcuffs go on him. You know, obviously he's got handcuffs on him for a reason. You know what I mean? It's that kind of mentality. Same thing. As soon as the bag goes over his head, it's like guilty. So this guy falls off the back of the truck, gets shoved or whatever. And the attitude in this room among officers, these are our leaders, you know, me included, is ambiguous. It's like we know that it's inappropriate. We know that's not the right way to go. And yet there's part of our sort of warrior sense or, you know, kind of like you're torn. And it's difficult moment to moment to manage that. It really is.
Why did you ultimately decide to choose to leave the Marines?
I guess there'd be a couple of reasons from a just a sort of a personal state of mind perspective. I was having a lot of difficulty. I was basically not sleeping 1-2 hours a night. I was I'd go to bed with the family 10-11 o'clock, and then I'd just get up an hour later, and I'd come into work, into the office, and I was a rifle company commander at the time, and I'd just sit there and read about all of the tragedies going on in Iraq. I would just immerse my mind in
this. Is when
all
you'd come home already.
That's right. Yeah. I'm, and we're preparing to go back to Iraq, right, in 9 months. And the days are, you know, we're already in that mode. And it's not as though I'm thinking of Iraq in any kind of productive way. I mean, you know, I mean, just absolutely immersed in you know, in raw emotion, and it's consuming me. And so from that point of view, I'm really not able to do my job effectively, and it's getting worse. Physically and mentally, I am on a downward spiral, no question about it. But then there's also the moral component of it too, and where I had felt like I couldn't continue to serve this mission. It just was not right in my mind. And you know, I came to sort of have more reverence for my Marines than I did for the mission, and that's you can't do that as a commander. You've got to love, as I say in the book, you got to love your mission more than your Marines. Unfortunately, but that's a reality. It's a reality that every commander understands. Because if you didn't, then you wouldn't be willing to send them into harm's way. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be willing to deploy them up a machine gun hill or down Route Jackson, you know, on some patrol or whatever. You wouldn't be willing to do those things unless you believed in the mission more than you did your own people. And it got to be where that, for me, that ratio was inversed. And I knew that pretty much disqualified me from
Were you shunned when you announced that you were leaving, or when it became known that you were leaving the Corps?
No, not at all, but I didn't make a big show of it. I just said it's time for me to go, and I didn't talk to the Marines about it, and that was a difficult decision for me, and I thought about it long and hard. What do I say? Do I walk out the door and say this, you know, this whole thing is a sham, don't go? I didn't think that that was a fair thing to do from my role, and the reason why is because I had a choice. I had the luxury of walking out, and they didn't. They were going one way or the other, and of course I want them to find out all that they can, but I didn't feel that like it was my role. It was a good way for me to do it, you know.
You write that it was hard for you once you left. You have a sentence there that's stuck in my mind that I wrote down here. Suddenly I lost my people.
Yeah, I mean, this has been sort of a major chapter for me since getting out. I mean, you know, who is Tyler Boudreau now? I mean, the book is subtitled The Unmaking of a Marine, and in the most literal sense, that's what it is. I mean, it's not just like the unraveling of a Marine, but it's literally, I am no longer a Marine. Well, I've been a Marine my whole life. You know, I mean, I started basically, you know, in my mind from the age of 16. I literally, you know, in a physical sense from the age of 18. And then even in my college years when I'm not active duty, I mean, my head is 100% into the preparation of me being a Marine. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a Marine since I'm a teenager. And now all of a sudden, I'm not. Now I'm just Tyler Boudreau. What am I? Am I the former Marine? Is everything else the same except that I used to be in the service? And, you know, you find that that doesn't quite work. And, you know, you try to go into those old patterns and you find conflict. So, you know, just as an example, let's say I go back and hang out with the old buddies back in town and they're all gung-ho people. You know, they're all like, yeah, freaking military, war, and all that other business. And you say, geez, I'm not really feeling that way anymore. Does that mean that I'm not their friends anymore? Who are my friends now? Who's my crowd? So it's not – I mean, I lose the Marines, you know, very concretely because I walk out, I'm out of the Marine Corps. But even the people that I've always known, I come from a particular culture, a particular, you know, community, and now I'm sort of walking away from that, and that means that I'm without all of it.
I've been speaking with Tyler Boudreau. He's the author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. It's a really compelling story. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Tyler Boudreau, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.